Emma Donoghue's 2010 novel Room was a taut thriller about a mother and son held captive in a small shed, but her latest novel, Frog Music, takes on a much wider canvas. It's a historical murder mystery set in 1870 San Francisco based on the real-life killing of Jenny Bonet, a woman who was dubbed the cross-dressing frog catcher, and her relationship with the French burlesque dancer Blanche Bunon. It is published by Little Brown, and I'm very pleased that it brings Emma Donoghue back to our show today. Hello.
Nice of you to have me. Thank you.
You grew up in Ireland, spent time in England, now live in Canada. What brought you to a story that's set in San Francisco in the 1870s?
Well, the great thing about writing historical fiction is that once you've tried it once, you realize that the world is your treasure box. And why on earth should you stay in either your place or your time? So I just got hooked by this one particular real case. Jenny Bonet was such an extraordinarily ahead of her time character because she was cross-dressing, but in this very playful and irreverent way. She wasn't trying to disguise herself to keep a job. She had a kind of modern, you know, sardonic performativity about it, which might be routine on the streets of San Francisco today, but it was not in 1876.
And we don't call it cross-dressing these days.
No.
When a woman dresses in men's clothes.
We call it wearing what you like.
How did you come across this murder case?
Was it
a major news story in 1876?
It was, but Jenny Bonet has been remembered in a very... in a very small way, in that she pops up in histories and oral histories over the years, but just in a kind of capsule form. So I found a page about her in a book called Wild Women, about Victorian women. And I was just immediately hooked. And then the novel turned out to be, to my surprise, even more so about the other woman in the room when the bullets killed Jenny Bonet, Blanche, a French dancer. And in particular, the book turns out to be about Blanche's search for her missing baby, which was a theme that this book and Frog Music have in common, which I wasn't really expecting at all. I didn't expect the baby to loom so large.
And that's just something that developed as you did more research into the story.
Clearly, ever since I've had kids, I'm just preoccupied with parenthood. I was listening to your fascinating discussion earlier about fatherhood in inner cities. And, you know, these issues are just perennial. How do people manage to go through that metamorphosis of going from independent adult to responsible parent?
We learned that Blanche has come here from France, works as an exotic dancer and also as a prostitute. She's come here with two men, Arthur Deneuve and his friend Ernest Girard. Why did they leave France?
France was in quite a depression at the time, and the French government even offered tickets to San Francisco in a kind of lottery. So I think San Francisco has always been seen as the city of dreams, whether you were coming to mine gold or to mine gold in other ways by selling entertainment and hospitality.
Although this is a very different San Francisco. This is 30 years before the earthquake which transformed San Francisco.
It's
what was
true.
It like in 1876?
Well, it was known as the Paris of the West. It was seen as... you know, the far west, but very sophisticated as well, because it was a port city. And it was remarkably multinational, multicultural. It was full of, you know, Chilean miners and English people, Germans, Swedish. It was very hard to get domestic staff because nobody wanted to be tied down and be a servant. Everybody wanted to live free. And people typically boarded or rented instead of buying. And they typically ate out in restaurants instead of cooking at home. So a very speedy town.
Although, in this case, these three bought a house in Chinatown.
Blanche bought an apartment. And we know all this from the inquest report of Jenny's murder, that Blanche said to the coroner, "I owned that apartment and my man stole it from me and sold it against my will." So you get these wonderful little nuggets of detail emerging from the legal sources.
Did they buy it because it was less expensive than other parts of the city and a place where they might be left in peace because they had rather unconventional lives?
Well, it is interesting that they lived, they lived and worked in Chinatown. So they were a little cluster of French people within Chinatown. I think of them as roughly equivalent to the, you know, white bohemians who went and lived in Harlem in New York. And there's something to be said for being a little, you know, minority within a minority and a place where the police didn't go.
Would Arthur be called her pimp?
Interestingly, that was the English word. The French word was Mac, and a Mac meant a bit more like your idle boyfriend. He wasn't out there hustling up the trade and, you know, being the muscle. He was lying around being the glamour boy and wearing the jewelry that you bought him. So it was a very peculiar institution.
They could have worked in a circus. How did she wind up being an... I said burlesque dancer. Is that a good description? Exotic dancer?
Yeah.
Was this common in the West at that time?
Some people would say that San Francisco was founded by miners and prostitutes. Prostitution was a big business from the very beginning, and French
it was so
women
male,
in particular.
It was a
male-dominated
society.
It was a city of men for a long, long time. French women commanded very high prices, and they had a lot of social freedom. They were seen as the rulers of fashion. So I think prostitution was the kind of obvious line for her to get into as soon as she arrived in San Francisco.
Well, the San Francisco you're writing about here is going through an unrelenting heat wave. It's also in the midst of a smallpox epidemic. Were those two circumstances related?
Not at all. Smallpox was usually a winter disease. So just by pure, I was going to say good luck. I meant good luck to me as a writer. I didn't have to make any of this up. The city was in a record-breaking heat wave and a smallpox epidemic. And I knew that one of the characters, Arthur, got smallpox because, again, it was mentioned in just a throwaway line in the newspaper reports that he was lightly pocked.
And let's talk about that child, the son of Blanche and Arthur, known as Petit, short for Petit Arthur. He becomes a major figure in the story, even though he's only an infant. Would it be inconvenient for a woman like Blanche to have children?
Yes, a lot of women had children, and if they were unmarried, they found it virtually impossible to look after them. It was very difficult to get domestic servants to come and live in your house. And if you yourself were, say, working as a servant, you couldn't have your baby with you. There was still a huge social stigma. So Blanche and Arthur did what many people did. They farmed their baby out. They put the baby in full-time childcare elsewhere. And what Blanche doesn't realize at the start of the book is how grim an urban baby farm the child is in. And this is all based on newspaper exposés at the time. In fact, the owner of their baby farm, Dr. Hoffman, she was the first target later that year of San Francisco's Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. As soon as it was formed, the first person they went after was Dr. Hoffman because the conditions in her baby farm were just notorious.
Let's talk about Jenny now. How does she make a living?
She sold frogs, which I know
frogs legs were really popular.
Oh, yeah. In the French restaurants and in the Chinese restaurants. There were about 300 such restaurants. So she sold bags of live frogs. Before that, she'd been a shepherd. Before that, she'd been in a reformatory, the notorious San Francisco Industrial School. And before that, she'd been a child actress.
And she's just gotten out of jail because she wears men's clothes. Was that a crime?
Weirdly enough, it was. San Francisco was this city of freedom, but in the 1870s, its municipal government was trying to kind of clean it up and make it more like Philadelphia. So they banned things like kite flying and pigtails. They were trying to get the Chinese men off the streets, basically, after Chinese men had built the West. And they banned looking disfigured. That's the thing. You were allowed to be disfigured, but in the privacy of your own apartment. You couldn't be visibly disfigured. They banned women in bars. Now, that was a rule not actually observed, but it meant women,
especially when prostitutes are such an important part of the economy.
That's the paradox of the city. And then they banned cross-dressing, but Jenny was one of the only people they used that rule against. It was a rule hardly ever put into action, but they arrested her roughly monthly.
And then Jenny meets Blanche when she knocks it down with a bicycle. You invented that part.
I invented the bicycle because it was clear to me from the sources that Jenny, first of all, I could tell she didn't have a home because everybody else, their lodging was mentioned, their address. There was never an address mentioned of Jenny. So I decided that she was a kind of a freewheeling character, and I thought I would make that literal by giving her an interest in the extreme sport of its day, which was bicycle riding. This is the kind of bicycle that had a 5-foot front wheel. I had to write a scene in which Jenny teaches Blanche how to ride it, but I was at the limits of my imagination because I cannot imagine myself personally getting on a thing like that and setting off down a San Francisco hill in particular.
The novel begins with Jenny's murder in a bar in the outskirts of the city, and the story moves backward and forward from that moment to tell us how Jenny and Blanche came to be in that place together and what Blanche does after the murder. Why did you decide to structure the novel in that way rather than in a straightforward chronological narrative?
One reason was I wanted to capture the kind of elusive, literally slippery quality of Jenny. Clearly not everybody in her life knew about all the different parts of her past. She was very playful, but not very open and honest. So I thought it would be fun to start with her murder and have Blanche gradually discover her.
Now, this isn't your first novel based on historical murder.
My first one was
based on an 18th century murder case in the Welsh Borders.
That's right. And I published that one back in 2000. So for 14 years, I've been doing this on and off. I've always moved comfortably between the contemporary and the historical.
Well, you did very well with Room, which was a national bestseller. Now being made into a film?
Yes, I'm the script writer and we're in the middle of casting it. We hope it'll be filmed in North America this year. It's very exciting to have got to that point.
Was the real murder ever solved?
No, the police came up with a theory, but they blamed a dead Canadian. So they blamed a Canadian who had
Canadian
already killed
connection.
Himself in jail. And it just seems way too convenient to me to say, oh, yeah, that must have been him. So I don't believe that version at all.
Well, in working on something like this, do you think that modern research methods, the magic of the Internet, for example, can give you insights into a case like this that detectives at the time couldn't have had?
I definitely do, because I was drawing on, I found almost 60 newspaper articles, and each of those reporters had, you know, talked to different neighbors and people. So I think putting all that together, and I had access to things like the Mormon database, for instance, showed me that Arthur got married to somebody else 2 months after the murder. So all sorts of fascinating little insights into people's character. So I think I probably have as good a chance of coming up with the truth about this case as anyone has.
Well, you can have somebody like E.L. Doctorow who says he doesn't really worry about the historical facts. You obviously do. And how important is getting all the details right for you?
It's not that it's a rule for the genre. Readers might be perfectly content if I didn't, but it's a great pleasure for me. I find it a great discipline to work with and around the facts and to only let myself say, I let myself speed things up a bit because legal cases always happen too slowly in real life.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, Doctorow produces the most wonderful results with a different technique. I found his novel, The March, really inspiring on that kind of post-Civil War mood, you know, the feeling of having a broken country.
You have a lot of music in here, songs like The Daring Young Men, Flying Trapeze, Little Brown Jug. The novel is called Frog Music. We can't get into why, because we've run out of time, unfortunately. But Emma Donoghue, thank you so much for coming by. And you will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. The book is published by Little Brown. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.